Blog Talk Radio.
Take back control.
gentlemen, and welcome to the Rifleman Radio Show. Rifleman Radio Show is dedicated to bringing you the absolute best information possible on rifle marksmanship, rifle safety, the heritage and history belonging to this great nation, and the things that each and every one of us can do to safeguard the freedoms and liberties that living in this nation affords us. I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. We're going to be discussing tonight the Battles of August of the American Revolutionary War. We're going to take a kind of a short break from our series on the Prepared Rifleman. We'll pick it back up next week. I just I don't want to get too far away from some of the other things we do, like talking about the history of the American Revolutionary War. I find it absolutely fascinating, and I love to read about it. I love to discuss it, and I hope you guys do too. You're welcome to call in to the show if you have any questions or if you want to make a comment about the battles, or if you want to thank some of your local Appleseed Project crew, you can call them. The number is 347-308-8790. 347-308-8790. Once you call in, Sam, the co-host and call screener, will grab you off the air and just ask you what you want to talk about and get you set up, and then let me know, and then we'll get you on the air. All right? Like I said, you can call in basically about anything. We'll be glad to take your calls. If you want to thank your local Appleseed crews for the work that they're doing, the time that they're volunteering in order to push the mission forward and to do their bit to ensure that Americans are being taught the absolute best fundamentals of rifle marksmanship program in the nation, then please do so. If you want to talk about the American Revolutionary War, then we'll be glad to take your calls on that, too. We'll be talking about the Battles of August tonight. We'll be talking mainly about, we're going to focus on the Battle of Long Island, because that's going to be one of the most important battles of August across the eight long bloody years of the American Revolutionary War. But we'll touch on a few of the others. I've got the whole list of the Battle of August. And August is one of the most active months for fighting during the war. There were many battles each year in the month of August because which could be classified as, you know, late fall to early spring, were generally not fought in the inclement weather. They were mainly fought in fairly decent weather because there were no Gore-Tex, there were no heated vehicles, things like that. Gunpowder was loose and poured into a loose open tray on the muskets. So anytime there was bad weather, then it certainly tended to put a damper on the fighting. They tried to concentrate most of their fighting during the warmer, drier months. And August is certainly one of those. So there's probably, I didn't look at the list, but there's probably about maybe two dozen battles during the months of August from 1775 to 1782. 1783, there weren't any battles. There were actually very few battles fought, especially in North America. There were a few other battles fought kind of finishing up around the world. We had battles in the Bahamas and Cuddalore, which was a naval siege, the Turkish and Caicos Islands. There were other sea battles in 1783 finishing up because, remember, the American Revolutionary War was actually the very first world war, and it was fought on almost every continent with a long list of countries they were fighting each other. It wasn't just America and England. It wasn't just the North American colonists fighting against England. There were the Dutch, the French, the Spanish, you name it. Everybody that had a grievance with somebody else, where they were picking this time to try and settle some of those grievances. And we'll talk about when we talk about the battle tonight. I'll mention some of the other battles that weren't fought in North America, but I've got them on the list anyway, so you'll kind of see that it was an actual world war. It wasn't just being fought simply in New England. It was fought all over the eastern seaboard, from Maine to the Gulf of Mexico, up and down the Mississippi River, and then from there into the North Sea, into the coasts of Europe, Africa, South America, India, you name it, and somebody was fighting someone somewhere. I want to thank everybody again for listening tonight. We certainly appreciate it. And I'd also like for you guys to make sure that you, well, I'm doing the series right now on the Prepared Rifleman, and we're doing a lot of discussion about self-reliance and about prepping. And I'm hoping that that's something that you guys want to hear about, because I thought quite a bit about the information that the radio show should be putting out. And in my mind, I'm thinking that one of the best things that I can do for folks right now is to make sure that I'm putting out information that can help you to weather man-made and natural disasters, cessation of services, to help you become more self-reliant in the event that you have to do so, in the event that you have to depend on yourself. And, you know, depending on yourself and being self-reliant, you don't need a man-made or natural disaster or a cessation of services for this to be a benefit to you, right? It can help you in your everyday life. If you can grow even just 1 5-pound sack of potatoes, then you saved yourself that much that you had to buy. And you've taught yourself that much about growing potatoes and about being self-sufficient. So the things that that we're talking about, I want to make sure you understand, these things aren't just for the end of the world or the zombie attack or the alien invasion. These are things that you should be doing and incorporating into your everyday lifestyle, making them habits in your everyday lifestyle, especially with things like we talked about last week about the personal safety in your everyday life. That is certainly doesn't require any type of end of the world scenario for you to benefit from that. Like we talked about last week, the world is a dangerous enough place without there being any end of the world, right? It's still a dangerous place, and you don't need the end of the world to come for you to put yourself in danger. You're living in danger every single day, and some of us more than others, and the best way to make it through it is to be continuously stacking the odds in your favor. That means doing the things that you can do in order to be stacking the odds that you will have your home broken into, or that you'll put yourself in a position where you can be assaulted or robbed or something like that. You're keeping those things to a minimum, right? And we'll talk about that again a little bit next week, because last week we got most of the way through it, but there are a few more things I want to talk to you about. But we'll talk about that again for a few minutes this next week. I wanted to finish talking about things you can do to provide for your personal safety when you're away from the home. We talked about personal safety in the home, but I want to finish up next week. We're talking about some things that you can do when you're away from home, which is then a whole lot different than in the home, but there are a few things that are different. Tonight we're going to talk about the battles of the American Revolutionary War. Now, we know that that the American Revolutionary War began in earnest on April 19th, 1775. And that's when an expeditionary force sent out to seize the weapons, gunpowder, any weapons of warfare, etc., were that were being kept in Concord. General Gage sent a force out to seize those. The force was repelled and then had to fight their way all the way back to Boston. By the end of the day, the British forces in the colonies were penned up in Boston, and a siege began, and the siege lasted basically for a whole year until the troops were forced out of Boston after the the artillery pieces were taken and placed in Dorchester Heights and were able to threaten the port of Boston. The British packed up and left him. There were a few additional skirmishes between the time that the siege began and the time that it ended, and then immediately after. The first of these that occurred in August was the Battle of Gloucester, and that was on August 5th or so. The British ship, the Falcon, this was commanded by John Lindsay, was cruising off the coast and then sailed right off of Ipswich Bay. And Captain Lins then sent a barge of men, once he got into the bay, sent a barge of men to the shore in search of livestock. Now, that's because that during the siege of Boston, there were no way to get any supplies or provisions by land. Anything that came into Boston had to come by way of sea. The British fleet still controlled the sea, and any provisions coming into Boston, every single thing that came into the town had to come by sea. I mean, they sent a lot of ships out to forage for provisions, hay, livestock, any kind of food, anything like that. And that's what Captain Lindsay was doing with his ship. Anyway, once he had entered Ipswich Bay, he sent in a barge of men on shore to search for livestock. Now, there was a local farmer, though, who happened to see the guys coming in. He took off and rounded up a few of the other local folks, and they gathered together, and before the barge could land, they drove the barge off with musket fire. And then the barge ended up returning to the ship, the Falcon, HMS Falcon. Then Lindsay sent it to investigate a ship that was in the harbor. There was a schooner in the harbor. But the ship only had ballast in its hold. That's when ships were empty, they had to have something in them to make sure that they sat in the water correctly. And most of the time, it was things like large rocks, or it could be metal bars for ballast, something that was fairly heavy but not bulky. And we could set at the center point of the ship, at the lowest point, and keep the ship upright in the water and let it have it be drawing the right amount of water. And when they checked the ship, that's all it had, just had ballast in it. But Captain Lindsay continued to cruise off the Cape for the next few days, and as he was driving along, he actually stopped at a few of the local ports and pressed some of the local men. By impressed, I don't mean he like showed off his muscles or anything. What I mean is the British, the Navy, had a habit of just pulling into a port and grabbing three, four, five, six, a dozen men and saying, all right, guys, you are now part of the English fleet, whether they wanted to or not. They would just grab them, if need be, put them in chains, take them to the ship, and they were now British seamen. And that's what they did as they were going up down the coast. Now, on about the 8th or 9th of August, the records weren't exactly clear on it. Captain Lindsay spotted a couple of American schooners making sail for Salem early in the morning, right around 8 o'clock. Now, his ship quickly overtook and captured one of the schooners of that incident. And despite what the movies, what you see in the movies, which is, you know, every time one ship sees another one in a war or something, they begin firing their cannons and sharpening their swords and stuff like that. Matter of fact, that was not the rule. The rule was, when a ship that was bigger than yours pulled up beside you, you just stopped and you did whatever they asked you to do, because if not, they would shoot you and kill you and sink you. So most of the time, the ships did not engage in battle. They simply struck their colors and they stopped and they said, okay, whatever you need me to do, I will. If they could get away, they would. But normally, if they could not get away, then they would stop, they would lower their sails, and they would allow themselves to be boarded. That's what Lindsay did with this one, and he took the crew of the prize. He put his own crew aboard the ship to man it before taking off after the second schooner. Now, the second schooner, the captain was familiar with the area, and he sailed his ship into an anchorage in the harbor. Then he sent a crew of 36 of his men on three small boats, Lindsay sent a crew of his men on three small boats to capture the ship. Now, he stopped his ship a little bit farther out. He put his 36 of his men in boats and sent them after the schooner that admits to an anchorage here in the harbor. Now, among the crew that was sent out were 10 of the guys that had been impressed, 10 of the Americans, including four folks from Gloucester. Once Captain Lindsay's ship, the Falcon, sailed in, it caused townspeople to raise the alarm, and the Gloucester militia companies began to muster, led by their captains, Captain Joseph Foster and Bradbury Sanders. Now, the militia was only armed with muskets and two old small swivel guns. Nonetheless, they opened fire from the shore at the small boats as they were nearing the schooner. The guys in the boat started rowing as fast as they could, and they boarded the schooner, but it didn't do any good because then they were trapped by constant fire from the shore because they had to row in closer the shore to get on the ship. Now they were within easy range of musket fire from the shore. Captain Lindsay tried to distract the townspeople. He started firing the Falcon's guns on the town, and eventually he mustered up a landing party that he sent ashore, or he tried to send ashore in boats to set the town on fire. But the attempt to gain the shore and burn the town was not successful. The party on the grounded schooner continued to be harassed by fire from shore. The lieutenant was wounded in the action, and he and a few other of the men managed to escape from the grounded the ship in a skiff about around 4 o'clock, leaving the Falcon's master in charge. The remaining men on the grounded ship were eventually taken prisoner, including the poor guys who the Americans who'd been impressed by the the British. Now, by 7 o'clock, the small boats that night, the small boats had all been taken, and Captain Lindsay decided to send the schooner he had captured in to recover his men. He was hoping that, under cover of dark, he could send in the smaller schooner, grab his men, and take back out. But he was afraid that the crew of the captured ship, the one that was in the harbor, remember the 10 guys that were in there, that they had taken the opportunity to overpower the crew he had sent in there. And he decided that he could not do those guys any good or distress the rebels by firing. Therefore, he left. Lindsay's attempt to burn the town as a punishment for resisting his actions was echoed later in some larger naval actions. A little bit later in October, Admiral Graves ordered Captain Henry Mollett on an expedition of reprisal against the New England coastal communities, specifically including Gloucester as a target. And citing, among other justifications, Captain Lindsay's defeat at Gloucester, he sent a force in to attack them in a reprisal fashion. But once he got to Gloucester, he took a look at it. He said, well, the buildings were too far apart. They were too widely spaced for shelling the town to have much of an effect, and it wouldn't really do any good to try to set it afire either. But he continued on and ended up at Falmouth, which today is the city of Portland name, and he burned Falmouth. Now, the burning of Falmouth was instrumental in motivating the Second Continental Congress. Once the Second Continental Congress had met, it motivated them to establish the Continental Navy. Okay? So that was the Battle of Gloucester, and that was fought between the 5th and the 9th of 1775. At the end of August, August 30th or so, a frigate, the HMS Rose, commanded by Sir James Wallace, pulled up outside Stonington and shelled Stonington for the better part of a day, or August 30th. It really had no real effect, and he pulled up anchor and left. On August, let me back up just a little bit later. That's the, and that is the end of the 1775 battles of August. All right, now that's going to take us to the Battle of Long Island. Okay. The actual Battle of Long Island, which later became known as the Battle of Brooklyn and more commonly known as the Battle of Brooklyn Heights, which is where the majority of the fighting took place. The actual battle was fought on August 27th, 1776. Now, this was the first major battle in the American Revolutionary War after the United States declared its independence. Remember, the independence was declared July 4th, 1776, and was released to the public, was told to the public on July 6th, 1776. And this is the first battle that was fought after the Declaration of Independence. Now, I know a lot of people don't think about it or don't realize it, but for the first year of the war was not being fought as a war of secession, or a war to secede from Britain, or a war of independence. It was a war being fought to try and force England to grant the colonists the same rights and privileges held by the citizens of Great Britain and England. We were a colony of England, and we simply wanted the same rights and privileges that our parent nation had, our parent country. And there were certainly folks that thought about it. I'm sure there were some folks that talked about it, but not many. A matter of fact, for the first full year, over and over again, there were attempts at finding peace with the king. All of the attempts were rebuffed. Finally, the colonies declared independence. Now, after defeating the British in the Siege of Boston on March 17, 1776, General George Washington, who was commander-in-chief, brought the Continental Army to defend the strategic port city of New York. This was then limited to the southern end of Manhattan Island. Now, Washington thought that the city's harbor would provide an excellent base for the British Navy during the campaign, and he wanted to deny this to him. So he established defenses, and he waited for the British to attack. Even though all of the advice from all around him told him this was not a good idea. Remember, New York is an island. And if you're on an island, then the only way on or off the island is by water. Therefore, whoever controls the water controls the island. And at the time, the colonies had no real navy. And England had the largest and most impressive navy in the world. So the idea of trying to successfully defend an island, especially one as large as New York, without holding command of the water surrounding it, certainly lent itself to the idea that it was going to be a failure. And Washington had been advised of this, and yet he still thought that it needed to be done, that New York needed to be held. He figured it was going to be the next logical location for attack, and he wanted to try and deny it to England. I'm sure he wanted to try out his new army, the new Continental Army. And you have to remember that Washington in 1776 was not the same Washington that we see in 1782. There's a very sharp learning curve as a commander. And Washington, up to this point, had really not had that much of a military career. He had been a member of the British forces during the French and Indian Wars, and even then did not command any great number of troops. And now here he is as the overall commander of a country. And it took him a good while to become confident in his ability to command men in battle. And it took him a good amount of time to understand what advice he should listen to, what he shouldn't, what risk he could take, what risk he couldn't. and become confident to believe in the decisions that he had to make. However, at this time, he didn't make a lot of great decisions. In July, the British, under the command of General Howe, landed just a couple of miles across the harbor on the sparsely populated Staten Island, where over the next month and a half, they were slowly reinforced by ships in the lower New York Bay, eventually bringing the total British force to 32,000 men. Now, with the British fleet in control of the entrance to the harbor at the Narrows, Washington knew the difficulty in holding the city. He thought that Manhattan would be the first target, and he moved the bulk of his forces there. On August 22nd, the British landed on the shores of Gravesend Bay and southeast Kings County. This is right across the Narrows from Staten Island, more than a dozen miles south from the East River, crossing into Manhattan. Now, after 5 days of waiting, the British began their attack, and they started with the defenses on Guam Heights. Unknown to the Americans, however, Howe had brought his main army around their rear and attacked their flank right after that. The Americans, of course, panicked. Although there was a stand by 400 extremely brave Maryland troops, which prevented the bulk of the army from being captured, the remainder of the army fled to defenses on Brooklyn Heights. The attack at the end of the day, however, was not pursued. The British dug in for a siege, but on the night of the 29th, Washington evacuated the entire army across the East River to Manhattan without the loss of any material or a single life. Washington and the whole Continental Army were very quickly driven out of New York after several more terrible defeats and were forced to retreat through New Jersey all the way in to Pennsylvania. Well, let's talk about how this happened. Now, we talked a few minutes ago about how the British Army was trapped in Boston. On March 4th, Washington ordered artillery to be placed in Dorchester Heights. And Howe knew then, once he saw the artillery there overlooking the harbor, that he couldn't hold the city. The artillery was manning the heights. Now, it wasn't close enough to be a disastrous threat, but the larger guns could actually reach the harbor, and the ships in the harbor were not going to be able to fight back. So, since he could not hold the city with the artillery on the heights that would threaten the British fleet, Howe packed up and moved out. There was some discussion, and he sent a note to Washington letting him know that if his guys were allowed to leave, they would not burn the city and destroy it. So within 2 weeks, every British soldier and a good number, several thousand loyalists, were packed up on ships, and they sailed out of New York and made landfall in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Now, once the British had abandoned Boston, Washington began to round up the regiments from the new Continental Army and began to send them in pieces to New York City. He believed that the main British attack would be there because of the strategic importance of New York. Washington left Boston on April 4th, and the army took a route to Rhode Island and Connecticut. And, of course, all of the local folks came out. They lined the roads, cheering and giving food and drink to the soldiers. Remember, the war had not struck home yet. There'd been some fighting in Concord and in Lexington on the long battle road back to Boston. There'd been fighting at Bunker Hill. I told you about some of the other fighting that happened along the coast of New England. But for all intents and purposes, the war had not been brought to the colonies as it would be over the next 6 years. So the folks were out celebrating, lining the way. On the April 5th, the army marched into Providence, and thousands of folks came out and lined the route to see Washington and the army pass. By April 13th, Washington and his men had made it to New York. Washington took up headquarters in a large home on Broadway and quickly set to work. Washington on Broadway. Of course, it looked a lot different then than it does now. And they began to try and transform the city into a fortress. Washington sent his second in command, Charles Lee, ahead of him to New York when he left, to start begin building the defenses for the city. Lee remained in control of the city's defenses until Congress grabbed him and tasked him to head to South Carolina in March. And the job for preparing the defenses was then transferred to General William Alexander, alternate Lord Stirling. Now, because Lee and Stirling did not have enough troops to finish the defenses before he left, when Washington arrived, he found that only a portion of the defenses had actually been completed. Lee figured that if the British commanded the sea, it would be impossible to hold the city. So when he began building his defenses, it wasn't to stop the British from landing, because as I said, there's no way you can stop a force that controls the sea from landing on a large island like that. There's simply no way. Well, not without 100 times the number of forces that Washington had available. So what Lee decided was that he would build his defenses with the idea that he would force the British to pay with heavy casualties all along the route they would have to take in order to gain any ground from the Americans. Lee began building barricades and redoubts established in and around the city, along with a bastion called Fort Stirling, built along Brooklyn Heights. And while in New York in command of the troops, Lee sent out troops to clear Long Island of any loyalists left on the island. He was rounding up the loyalist troops. I mean, the loyalists, they weren't troops. They were simply folks who had declared that they were going to remain loyal to the British crown. He began rounding them up and forcing them off the island. And Washington, once he arrived, he began moving troops to the Brooklyn area in early May. Within a short time, there were several thousand men stationed in Brooklyn. Now, on the eastern side of Brooklyn, there were three more forts that Washington began constructing in order to support the main line of defense, which is Fort Stirling. That was the bastion along Brooklyn Heights. The three forts were named Fort Putnam, which is not the same. They're not the same Fort Putnam, which is connected to West Point. Fort Greene, named for Nathaniel Greene, and Fort Box, named for Major Daniel Box. Fort Putnam was the furthest defense to the north, with Greene slightly to the southwest, and Box was a little bit further to the southwest. If you look on the show page, I put a map of the Brooklyn defenses, of the Long Island defenses on there, and that should be included on there if you take a look at that. all the forts were surrounded with by large ditches, and they were all connected by lines of entrenchment. So you get from one fort to the other by entrenchments. The forts had 36 cannons in total, mostly the 18-pounder size, which are not, they're not the biggest, but they're not the smallest either. Fort Defiance was also being built right around the same time. This was located even further to the south. This was past Fort Box, near present-day Red Hook. In addition to these new forts, a mounted battery was established on Governor's Island. Cannons were placed at Fort George, and even more cannons placed at the Whitehall Dock, which was right on the East River. They sunk as many hulks of old ships as they could at strategic locations, trying to prevent the British from entering the East River and other waterways. That's where you take, they took the older ships and they would purposely sink them so that the British fleet could not gain access to the East River. Congress had authorized Washington to recruit up to 29,000 men, but he'd only had 19,000 when he got to New York. Now, there was almost no discipline in the Army at this time. Remember, this was a brand new Continental Army. Nobody knew how to be in an Army. None of them had ever been in an Army. Maybe a few of the guys had been in the Army during the French and Indian War 20 years earlier, but for all intents and purposes, nobody had ever been in an Army before. They didn't know how to act. The commanders didn't know how to command. Nobody knew how to keep discipline. The camp's hygiene was absolutely horrific. Simple orders had to be repeated over and over again. There were the undisciplined firing of muskets in the camp all the time. Guys ruined their flints. They're using their bayonets to dig with and cut food, and most of them never bothered to even clean their muskets. This was really the first time that any large group of guys had ever seen other folks from any of the other colonies. This was the first time that many of the men from the different colonies had ever been around each other. And remember, the colonies were not a homogeneous mixture. Each colony had begun with its own specific rules and laws and its own specific ways to do things and attitudes and everything else. And this, throwing all these guys together all at once in such a large amount, ended up causing a great deal of conflict. Now, not only was the Army new, but the artillery was new. They had a fairly decent amount of artillery, thanks to Henry Knox, who had taken a great deal of time and effort to round up artillery from across the colonies, from captured British forts and any of the state's militias' artillery that he could get. But there weren't any artillery folks because there had not been a standing artillery regiment or a need for one previously. So Henry Knox persuaded Washington to transfer about 600 men who did not have muskets to begin with. That was another problem with the Army at the time. Although he had 19,000 men, he did not have 19,000 muskets to go with these men. Some of the men had axe handles. Some had lances and spears or swords or axes, but they didn't all have muskets. They were trying as desperately as they could to get muskets for the men, but Knox persuaded Washington to give him about 600 men who didn't have muskets anyway and place them into the beginning of what would become the Continental Artillery. In early June, Knox and Greene took a look at the land at the north end of Manhattan and decided to establish Fort Washington there. Well, Fort Washington was going to be able to cover the river. Then another fort, Fort Constitution, later named Fort Lee, was planned for the other side of the Hudson River, right across from Fort Washington. Now, the purpose of these two forts was to be able to stop British troop ships, or British any ships of the line, from sailing up the Hudson River in order to attack New York, the city of New York. On June 28th, Washington learned that the British fleet had set sail from Halifax, and on June 9th, that the information given to him said that they were heading for New York. On June 29th, signals were sent from men stationed on Staten Island that the British fleet had appeared. Within a few hours, 45 British ships dropped anchor in Lower New York Bay. 45 ships all at once. They said the ship just kept appearing and kept appearing. Everybody in the city stopped everything that they were doing. They began to line the waterfront. They were watching the tops of buildings. The city was going into a panic. Now, it finally settled down because the ships weren't attacking. They were simply beginning their formation. Now, within less than a week, there ended up being over 130 ships at anchor right off Staten Island under the command of Richard Howe. That was the brother of General Howe's. The whole population of New York went into a panic as soon as they saw the British ships. Alarms went off all over the island. Troops immediately began rushing to their posts. However, the British were not attacking. But by July 2nd, the British troops began to land the British ships began to land the troops on Staten Island. The few Continental regulars on the island took a few pot shots at the British before immediately fleeing back across the river. And the citizens' militia, the folks that lived there on Staten Island, immediately switched over to the British side. Okay, we're with you guys now. On July 6th, news ended up reaching Washington, New York, that Congress had voted for independence 4 days earlier. So Congress had voted for independence on the 2nd. They had announced it on the 4th. By the 6th, it reached New York City on July 9th at 6 o'clock in the evening. Washington had several of his brigades march onto the commons of the city to hear the Declaration of Independence read aloud. After the end of the reading of the Declaration, there was a huge mob that ran all the way down to Bowling Green, and there was a statue of George III. They took ropes, tied the ropes and bars onto the statue, and tore down the lead statue of George III on a horse. He was sitting on a horse. It was gilded in gold, but the statue, of course, was made of lead. The crowd, in their fury, cut off George's head, chopped off the nose, and they mounted what remained of the head on a spike outside a tavern. The rest of the statue was dragged all the way to Connecticut, and there they chopped it up, melted it down into musket balls. On July 12th, the two British ships, the Phoenix and the Rose, sailed up the harbor toward the mouth of the Hudson. Now, the American batteries that Knox had placed at Fort George, Red Hook, and Governor's Island opened fire. The British returned fire into the city of New York. The ships sailed along the Jersey shore, continued up the Hudson, sailing past Fort Washington, and arriving by nightfall at Tarrytown, which is on the widest part of the Hudson there. The goal of the British ships was to cut off American supplies and encourage Loyalist support. The only casualties of the day, even though there had been hundreds and hundreds of artillery rounds fired, the only casualties were six Americans who were killed when their own cannon blew up for an unknown reason. Now, this should have ended Washington's whole idea of defending New York. He was defending New York based on the idea that the American batteries at Fort George, Red Hook, Governor's Island, Fort Washington, and Fort Lee were going to be able to deny the Hudson to the British. And on this day, the two ships, they sailed all the way up and all the way back without any problems whatsoever. That should have been his signal right then and there that he was not going to be able to do anything to prevent the British from commanding the water and therefore making landfall anywhere they wanted and putting the Continental forces at great peril from being cut off, surrounded, and captured on the island. The next day, on July 13th, General Howe attempted to open negotiations with the Americans. Howe sent a letter to Washington delivered by Lieutenant Philip Brown, who arrived under the flag of truce. The letter was addressed George Washington, Esquire. Brown was met by Joseph Reed, who, on Washington's orders, had hurried to the waterfront accompanied by Henry Knox and Samuel Webb. Washington, once the letter had been delivered, Washington asked his officers whether they thought it should be received or not, because it did not recognize his rank as general. And his whole staff unanimously said no. Washington and everybody else immediately saw what Howe was doing. He was not recognizing, not only was he not recognizing Washington as commander of the Continental forces, but he was not recognizing the validity of the American forces at all. So by sending his letter addressed that way, George Washington Esquire, he was trying to get around it. Brown was end up being told by Washington Secretary Reed that there was no one in the Army with that address. On the 16th of July, 3 days later, Howe tried it again. This time he addressed it George Washington, Esquire, etc., etc. And he was hoping that this would cover all of the bases. That by saying et cetera, then by all means, that meant that he was addressing any and all titles or ranks that Washington might be using. But Washington wasn't going to have that. And again, the letter was declined. Now, the next day, on the 17th, Howe sent Captain Nisbet Balfour to ask if Washington would please meet with Howe's adjutant face-to-face. And a meeting was scheduled for July 20th. Howe's adjutant was Colonel James Patterson. Patterson told Washington that Howe had come with powers to grant pardons to Washington and the men under his command. Washington's answer to Colonel Patterson was, "Those who have committed no fault want no pardon." Patterson departed soon afterward. Now, Washington's performance during the meeting was praised throughout the United States. Now, what I mean by performance was it the British Army, the British forces, the British royalty, all stood like a long tradition of ceremony and process, and they I'm sure that they didn't expect for Washington and the Continental forces to do the same. However, Washington conducted himself with all of the grace and professionalism that the highest ranking British general would have. And that's how he treated Colonel Patterson. They made sure that whenever the meeting was held, everything was set up perfectly. They took great pains to set up the room perfectly, to have the escorts who brought Patterson to the meeting were specifically handpicked and trusted. All the uniforms were impeccable. All the ceremonies were observed. Everything was done exactly as it would have been had Washington been the commander of some other European nation's army with hundreds of years of history. That's what the whole idea was. That's what the whole purpose was. To let the British forces, especially General Howe, know that this wasn't some fly-by-night thing. This wasn't going to go away. Meanwhile, during the peace negotiations, British ships continued to arrive. By the 1st of August, 45 additional ships with the addition of the Generals Henry Clinton and General Charles Cornwallis arrived, along with 3,000 additional troops. By August 12th, 3,000 British troops and another 8,000 Hessians had arrived. At this point, the British fleet sitting there offshore of New York numbered well over 400 ships, including 73 ships of war and 32,000 troops. Who now camped on Staten Island. Faced with this large force, Washington was unsure as to where the British would attack. Now, both Greene and Reed thought that the British would attack on Long Island, but Washington felt that a British attack on Long Island might be a diversion for a main attack on Manhattan. So Washington ended up breaking his army in half, took half of it to Manhattan, the other half he stationed on Long Island. The army on Long Island was commanded by Greene, and by the 20th of August, Greene became very seriously ill and was forced to move to a house in Manhattan, where he remained bedridden until he was able to recover. John Sullivan instead was placed in command until Greene was well enough to resume his command of his portion of the army. Finally, right around 5:10 a.m. on August the 22nd, there was an advance guard of right around 4,000 British troops under the command of Clinton and Cornwallis that left Staten Island to land on Long Island. By 8 a.m., all 4,000 troops had landed on the shore of Gravesend Bay unopposed. Colonel Edward Hands, Pennsylvania rifleman, had been stationed on the shore, but they did not oppose the landings and fell back killing cattle and burning farmhouses on the way was a kind of a scorched earth type retreat. By noon, 15,000 troops had landed ashore, along with 40 pieces of artillery. Hundreds and hundreds of loyalists came to greet the British troops. Cornwallis pushed on ahead with the advance guard, advancing over 6 miles on the island and establishing a camp at the village of Flatbush. I've always thought that was a novel sounding town in New York. At the time, it was just a village. Cornwallis then gave orders to advance no further at that time, at that point. Washington received word of the landings the same day that they occurred, but was informed that the number was 8,000 to 9,000 troops. Now, that's over half as much as what actually landed. This convinced Washington that the landing at Grazing Bay was the feint that he had actually predicted was going to be, and so he only sent 1,500 additional troops to Brooklyn, bringing the total number of troops on Long Island to 6,000. On August 24th, Washington replaced Sullivan, who had taken command when Greene was ill. Washington replaced Sullivan with Israel Putnam, who now commanded the troops on Long Island. Putnam arrived on Long Island the next day, along with 6 additional battalions. Also that day, the British troops on Long Island received an additional 5,000 Hessian reinforcements, bringing their total to 20,000. Now, although there was very little fighting on the days after the landing, there were some small skirmishes that did take place with American marksmen armed with rifles, pushing off British troops from distance quite a bit. So, when we talk about the events of April 19, 1775, there being no known rifles involved in the events of April 1775, by the time that the Battle of Brooklyn rolled around, there were a good many troops armed with rifled muskets, and they were using these to great advantage to shoot British troops from distance. Now, the American plan was that Putnam would direct the overall defenses there on Brooklyn Heights, while Sullivan and Sterling and their troops would be stationed along Guam Heights. Now, the heights were about 150 feet high, and they blocked the most direct route to Brooklyn Heights. So there was no good way that the British troops were going to get to Brooklyn Heights with Guam Heights and Brooklyn Heights being manned and defended. Now, Washington believed that by stationing them on the heights, that very heavy casualties could be inflicted on the British before the troops fell back to the main defenses at the Brooklyn Heights. There were 3 main passes through the heights. There was the Gowanus Road, which was the furthest route to the west, the Flatbush Road, which was a little bit further to the east, and then in the center of the American line, where everyone fully expected the British would make their main attack, was the Bedford Road, which was the farthest road to the east. Sterling was responsible to defend the Gowanus Road with 500 men. Sullivan was to defend the Flatbush and Bedford Roads with 1,000 and 800 men, respectively. I mean, you may think that this doesn't sound right with 500 men defending a road against 20,000. But if you look at the terrain there, what it is you have a ridge that's 150 feet high, 15 stories high. there's no way to get through it except for these three small passes. And the passes were very narrow. So you could, even if you had a force of 20,000 men, you're only going to be able to have a few men at a time in the front lines of the road. So 500 men defending the pass that was least expected to be used, and 1,800 men defending the additional passes, was a pretty decent defensive maneuver. 6,000 of the troops, of the Continental troops, would remain behind at Brooklyn Heights. Now, there was another lesser-known pass through the Heights that was well farther to the east called the Jamaica Pass. Now, this pass was defended by just 5 militia officers on horses. The thought was that no one was going to use that pass. It was way too far to be effectively used for the attack. On the British side, General Clinton learned about Jamaica Pass from the local loyalists. And he knew from the information he received that the pass was virtually undefended. So Clinton drew up a plan, and he gave it to William Erskine to propose to Howe. Clinton and Howe did not get along. And Clinton did not think that Howe, if he proposed a plan directly to Howe, that Howe wouldn't accept it. So he gave it to Erskine. He formed up a plan, he gave it to Erskine, and asked Erskine to propose the plan of attack through Jamaica Pass to Howe. And Clinton's plan used the main bulk of the army to make an all-night march, make an end run down to Jamaica Pass, go through the pass, and then turn the American flank, while the other troops, including the German Hessian troops, kept the Americans locked by the nose and kept them busy on the front. On the 26th of August, Clinton received word from Howe that the plan that he devised would be used, and that Clinton was to command the advance guard of the main army of 10,000 men that would end up making the end run down through Jamaica Pass. While they made the night march, General James Grant's British troops, along with some of the Hessians, about 4,000 men, would attack the Americans from the front at the position that they were most expected to attack in order to distract the enemy, to distract the Continentals from the main army that was going to be arriving with surprise on their flank. They told Clinton to be ready to move out that very night on the 26th. By 9 o'clock that evening, the British were moving out. No one except the commanders, not even the officers, knew of the plan. Clinton led a crack brigade of light infantry with 6 men at the front, followed by Cornwallis, who had 8 battalions and 18 artillery pieces. Cornwallis was followed by Howe and Hugh Percy with an additional 6 battalions, more artillery, and then the army's baggage. The column consisted of 10,000 men who stretched out over 2 miles. 3 loyalist farmers led the column toward the Jamaica Pass. The British had left their campfires burning in order to deceive the Americans into thinking that nothing was going on. They left all their fires burning. They left a few men to tend the fires, keep them burning bright, to bang things around, to yell to each other, things like that. And they were making their night march. Now, the column didn't run into any American troops. And finally, they reached Howard's Tavern, and I believe at the time it was also known as Howard's Halfway House, I believe. This was just a couple of hundred yards from Jamaica Pass. The tavern keeper, William Howard, and his son, William Jr., were forced to act as guides to show the British the way to the Rockaway footpath. This was an old Indian trail that skirted the Jamaica Pass to the west. Today, if you went to look for it, it would be right in the middle of the cemetery of the Evergreens. Now, 5 minutes after leaving the tavern, the five American militia officers who were stationed at the pass, to guard the pass, were captured without firing a shot. They rode up to the British troops, who they thought were Americans, and this is, you remember, this is in the middle of the night, they don't expect any British troops there. They rode up to them, and they were immediately captured. Clinton interrogated the men, and they told him that they were the only troops that were guarding the pass. By dawn, the British were through the pass and stopped so that the troops could rest. By 9 a.m., they fired two heavy cannons to signal the Hessian troops who were below the pass to begin their frontal assault against Sullivan's men, who were deployed on the two hills flanking the pass, while Clinton's troops simultaneously flanked the American positions from the east. Now, there's a footnote I wanted to tell you about, because a lot of the history can get dry about things that are going on, but there are thousands and thousands of individual stories for every main story that you hear. William Howard Jr. was the son of the tavern keeper, William Howard. These are the guy and his father who lived in the tavern right there at Jamaica Pass. And he describes that night. He said it was about 2 o'clock in the morning of the 27th of August that he was awakened just by seeing a soldier standing at the side of his bed. He said he got up and dressed and went down to the bar room where he saw his father standing in one corner with three British soldiers before him with muskets and bayonets fixed. The army was then lying in the field in front of the house. General Howe and another officer were in the bar room. General Howe wore a camlet cloak over his regimental uniform. After asking for a glass of liquor from the bar, which was given him, he entered into familiar conversation with William Howe Jr.'s father, and among other things said, "I must have some one of you to show me over the Rockaway path around the pass." To which his father replied, "We belong to the other side, General, and we cannot serve you against our duty." General Howe replied to Howard's father, "That is all right. That's fine. Stick to your country or stick to your principles. That's fine. But, Howard, you are my prisoner and must guide my men over the hill." Howard's father made some further objectives, but was silenced by the general, who held up his hand and said, "You have no alternative. If you refuse, I shall shoot you through the head." That's how William Howard and William Howard Jr. ended up as Howe's guides around Rockaway Pass. Around 11 p.m. on the 26th of 1776, the first shots of the Battle of Long Island were fired near the Red Lion Inn. Now, that's their present day location, which would be the intersection of 39th Street and 4th Avenue in Brooklyn, or Long Island. And this was done, the first shots were fired because the American pickets, part of John Attlee's Pennsylvania regiment, ended up shooting at two British soldiers who were trying to gather some watermelons from a watermelon patch near the Red Lion Inn. This was at 11 at night. So that's kind of when the first shots between the two sides began. Around 1 a.m. on the morning of the 27th, the British approached the vicinity of the Red Lion Inn with between 200 to 300 British troops. The American troops fired on the British, and after about two full shots by the American troops, they took off in flight up Gowanus Road toward the old Kelly Courthouse. Major Edward Byrd, who had been in command of those troops were captured, along with a lieutenant and 15 other privates. Now, the first engagement was fought in the vicinity of the current vicinity of the 38th, 39th streets between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. Newly promoted Brigadier General Samuel Holden Parsons, this guy, this is a lawyer from Connecticut, who just recently managed to secure a commission in the Continental Army, and Colonel Samuel Attlee, who were in command of the 1st Regiment of the Pennsylvania Musketry, and he was a veteran of the French and Indian War. They were stationed further north on the Gowanus Road. Putnam had been awakened by a guard at 3 a.m., and he was told that the British were attacking through Gowanus Pass. Putnam lit signals to Washington, who was on Manhattan, and then rode south to warn Sterling of the attack. The only thing that I'll remind you of is that when you hear about the recounting of battles, then at this time that it sounds awfully confusing, and you also wonder why things don't happen sooner and why there is so much confusion. And you have to remember that there was no electricity, there were no radios, there was no way to signal over great distances. And whenever somebody is told that someone's attacking, that they believe someone's attacking the Gowanus Pass, then even for Putnam to say, no, are you sure? He can't get an answer, sometimes perhaps for hours. You have to send a rider back to get more information. Then that rider has to return if he doesn't get lost or captured. And things move very slowly and very haltingly and very confusingly during the course of a battle, especially when you don't have line of sight. Sterling, along with the Delaware and Maryland regiments, ended up taking positions just north of Attlee's men on the slopes of a rise of land there forward of Gowanus Pass. Some of the Maryland troops were positioned on a small hill. At the base of this hill, the Gowanus Road crossed a small bridge over a drainage ditch, which drained into a marshy area, to a kind of a swamp. When the British advanced up the Gowanus Road, the American troops fired on them from positions on the north side of the ditch. To their left were Colonel Peters' Pennsylvania Regiment. Just to the southwest were a few hills. Amongst them was a hill which is the highest point in Kings County, which is 220 feet high, came to be known as Battle Hill. The British attempted to outflank the American positions by taking the hill. The Americans, trying to prevent the British move, also sent troops under Parsons and Attlee to take the hill. The British got there first, but the Americans were able to dislodge them in fierce fighting, including hand-to-hand fighting. Battle Hill was a site of some really brutal fighting, with the Americans at this point inflicting the highest number of casualties against their British troops during the entire Battle of Long Island. Among those killed was British Colonel James Grant, which led the Americans to mistakenly believe they had killed General James Grant by the same name, just a little bit higher rank. He'd been shot by a Pennsylvania rifleman who had been sniping at the British from up in a tree. Due to the ferocity of this fighting, the fighting that began there, and the number of the British troops engaged, the Americans were still unaware that this was not the main British attack. Like I said, the battlefield can get awfully confusing. Especially if you do not have good sight of the battlefield, you don't have good communications. Once any large body of soldiers begin firing, if you have 200 to 300 men facing 200 to 300 men firing, you have immediate smoke screens that are created by the black powder. At this same time, the Hessians, who were in the center, and they were under the command of General John Heiser, began to cannonade the American lines. that were stationed at Battle Pass under the command of General Sullivan. The Hessian brigades were waiting for the prearranged signal from the British, who at that time were in the process of outflanking the American lines, but they were not attacking yet. The Americans, still under the assumption that Grant's attack straight up Gowanus Road was the main thrust, had Sullivan send 400 additional men to reinforce Sterling. So they're still sending men to the center of the position along Gowanus Height, I mean, Gowanus Pass Road. And what they don't realize is that the main body is beginning to form up on their flank. By 9 a.m., Washington arrives from Manhattan. Now, Washington realized he'd been wrong about the feint on Long Island, and he ordered more troops to Brooklyn from Manhattan. Washington's location on Babylon really isn't known for sure because there are different accounts of where he was running the battle from, but more than likely, he was somewhere near Brooklyn Heights where he could have a better view of the battle. Like I said, you need to be able to see the battlefield in order to understand it and to make decisions. Now, on the American right to the west, Sterling still held his line against Grant. Sterling held on for 4 hours. He was still unaware of the British flanking maneuver, and some of his own troops actually thought they were winning the day because the British facing them had been unable to take their position. Sadly for them, what they didn't understand is they weren't trying to take the position. They thought they were fiercely fighting and holding the front. What they didn't realize is that the forces facing them weren't trying to take their position. They were mainly trying to keep them pinned down and make them think that the attack was coming there while they were being flanked. However, by 11 a.m., Grant, who now is being reinforced by about 2,000 Royal Marines, hit Sterling Center, and Sterling was attacked on his left by the Hessians at the same point. Sterling pulled back, but the British troops at this point were coming at him in his rear down the Gowanus Road. The only escape route he had left was across the mill pond on Gowanus Creek, which was about 80 yards wide. On the other side was Brooklyn Heights. Now, the mill pond, like I said, was about 80 yards wide, and it was surrounded by a swamp and bog. While trying to make the retreat, and Sterling ordered all the troops, except for a small contingent of about 400 other Marylanders under the command of Mordecai Gist, to take off, to head across the creek to get out of there. Now, the group of Maryland troops who became known in history as the Maryland 400, although they actually numbered about between 250 and 270 men, Sterling and Gist led the troops in a rearguard action against the British troops, which numbered well over 2,000 men, supported by two cannons. You have the 250 Marylanders who are locked down, and they are fighting to the last man. They're fighting like ferocious dogs against 10 times their number, and they were fighting them to a stop. They were the 250 Marylanders were fighting the 2,000 light infantry and Royal Marines to a stop, allowing Sterling to send the rest of the troops across Gowanus Creek. Sterling ordered them across, but Sterling and Gist led the Marylanders in two attacks against the British, who were in six positions in front of the courthouse. Today it's known as the Old Stone House. If you go there and take a look at it, at the battlefield, it's the Old Stone House. After the last assault, the few troops that were left tried to retreat across Gowanus Creek. Some of the men who tried to cross ended up being bogged down in the mud and being stuck in the mud, like up to their knees, and were cut down. Others who couldn't swim, you know, they waded out as far as they could, but they couldn't swim, so they didn't wade any further. They were captured. Stirling was surrounded. And unwilling to surrender to the British, with his sword and pistols, he broke through the British lines, fighting like a madman, broke through the British lines to von Hester's Hessian troops, the German troops, and surrendered to them. He fought his way through one group of enemy, the English troops, so he could surrender to the German troops. 256 of the Marylanders were killed in the assaults in front of the old stone house. Less than a dozen of the Maryland 400 ever made it back to American lines. Washington was watching them from a defensive position nearby on Copple Hill. And that is today, that's at the intersection of Court Street and Atlantic Avenue. He said to have turned to his aides and said, "Good God, what brave fellows I must this day lose." As the American troops who weren't killed or captured escaped behind the American fortified positions centered in Brooklyn Heights, Howe, in a move considered controversial to this day, ordered all of his troops to halt the attack, despite the protest of a great many of the officers in his command, who said they should push on. They should exploit the attack, push on to the Heights, and capture Washington's army then and there. Howe decided, however, against a direct frontal assault against the entrenched American positions on the Heights. Remember, this was within a year of the Bunker Hill disaster. It's believed that Howe did not want that repeated. Instead, he ordered the troops to encircle and begin setting up a siege and setting up positions for siege around the American positions. And he believed them to be trapped because his troops were blocking escape completely by land. The Royal Navy was in control of the East River, which would have to be crossed if they were going to reach any other land. The Americans had their backs against the East River. Washington and his whole army were surrounded on Brooklyn Heights with the East River to their backs. No way to get off. As the day went on, the British began to dig trenches, you know, slowly digging their way closer and closer to the Americans. They were kept from moving straight out by many of the American riflemen. So they were having to dig defensive trenches to get in close. Now, by doing this, the British wouldn't have to cross over the open ground to assault the American defenses as they had done in Boston the year before, as I was telling you about on Bunker Hill. And despite the perilous position they were in, Washington ordered an additional 1,200 men to be brought over from Manhattan to Brooklyn. The men that came over were two Pennsylvania regiments, along with Colonel John Glover's regiment from Marblehead, Massachusetts. These are the Marblehead, the rough seamen. Now, in command of the Pennsylvania troops was Thomas Mifflin, who, after arriving, he volunteered to inspect the outer defenses and report back to Washington. Now, in the outer defenses, the small skirmishes were still taking place. There was still fighting going on a bit, but there were no major pitch battles being fought. On the afternoon of the 28th, it began to rain, and Washington had his cannon all up and down the line continue to bombard the British well into the night. As the rain continued, Washington sent a letter to General William Heath, who was down at Kingsbridge between Manhattan and what's now the Bronx, to send every single flat-bottom boat or sloop without delay, in case battalions of infantry from New Jersey might need to come to reinforce their position. At 4 p.m. on the 29th, Washington had a meeting with the generals. Mifflin advised Washington to retreat to Manhattan while Mifflin and his Pennsylvania regiments made up the rear guard, holding the line until the rest of the army had withdrawn. The generals unanimously agreed with Mifflin that retreat was the best option, and Washington had orders to go out by the evening. Now, what most of the folks didn't know was that when Washington had sent out his initial letter to Heath to bring the flat-bottom boats or any other boats or sloops within distance to be sent to him so that he could bring other troops over, he certainly did not have the idea of bringing additional troops over. But that is what he wanted to make sure was known in case word of what he was doing was discovered. In addition to this, his orders to the troops was they were told that they were to gather up all of their gear, all their ammunition, all their baggage, everything they had, to prepare for a night attack against the British lines. By 9 o'clock, the 2nd Wounded began to move to the Brooklyn Ferry in preparation for being evacuated across the East River. By 11, Glover and his Massachusetts troops, who were sailors and fishermen, began to evacuate the troops. Now, this was a very difficult job. If you haven't seen the East River, then you don't understand the full consequences of this. The East River isn't a creek. It's miles across. Anyway, they began to ferry all of the troops there back across the lines. As the troops were being evacuated, more and more troops were being taken off the line, being told that they were being reformed for a night attack. But in reality, they were being marched to the ferry landing and ferried across the river, across the East River. Wagon wheels were bound up with anything they could use to muffle the sound of them. The men were forbidden to talk. Mifflin's men were doing the same thing that Howe's were. They set up campfires. They were tending the fires. A few men on the front line tending the fires, banging picks and shovels. Mifflin, rear guard, was tending the campfires. But at 4 a.m. on the 30th, a runner had been sent to Mifflin, telling him that it was his unit's turn to evacuate. Mifflin told the man who had been sent to order to leave, Major Alexander, that he must be mistaken, but Alexander told him that he wasn't, and it was a true order, and that Washington wanted him to leave now. So Mifflin ran up his troops, took off. When Mifflin was in a half mile of the ferry landing, Washington rode up to him and was absolutely furious and was demanding to know why he was there, why they weren't back there at the lines, at their defenses, and Mifflin tried to explain it to him, and Washington was completely sad, and they said he was yelling, good God, General Mifflin, you've ruined us, you've destroyed us. Now, Mifflin explained that what he'd been told and who he'd been told it to him, and Washington explained to him it had been a mistake, and asked him to take his troops back to the defenses and redeploy his men there. And I'm sure that wasn't a happy order, but Mifflin followed it. Artillery, supplies, troops, all were being evacuated across the river, but it was not going as fast as Washington had hoped. And all too soon, daybreak came. But at the same time as daybreak came, a fog settled in. A thick, heavy fog, and completely concealed the evacuation from the British. Now, British patrols noticed that there did not seem to be any American pickets and began searching the area. And while they were doing this, Washington, General Washington, who was the last man left, stepped onto the last boat leaving, and at, say, 7 a.m., began moving across the East River to Manhattan. and the British patrols who were searching the line actually witnessed this. All 9,000 troops had been evacuated without a single life loss and with all materials of warfare taken in whole. The British were absolutely stunned to find that Washington and the army had escaped. The next day, on August 30th, the British troops occupied the American fortification. Now, when news of the battle reached London, it caused festivities all across the country. Bells were rung in all of the in all of London's churches. Candles were lit in all the windows. King George III gave General Howe, he awarded him the Order of the Bath. Washington's defeat revealed his deficiencies as a strategist when he split his forces. His inexperienced generals who misunderstood the situation, his raw troops that fled in disorder at the first shots. However, on the other hand of this, on the other side of this, is daring nighttime retreat across the river has been described by a number of historians as one of his greatest military feats. He was able to save the bulk of the Continental Army in order for it to continue fighting. Now, General Howe remained inactive for about the next month. He didn't begin attacking men until around September 15th when he landed at Kipps Bay. The British quickly occupied the city, and by the 21st of September, they had occupied all of New York. Now, there was a fire, a mysterious fire that was started that destroyed over a quarter of New York. Now, Washington, of course, wanted to burn New York before he left, and he saw no reason whatsoever that he should have left the city standing for the British to occupy. The majority of the citizens of New York City were loyalists. The majority, over 90% of the citizens of New York, were loyalists, loyal to King George and the English. But he was denied permission to burn the city. However, somebody went in and did it, and there were a good many of folks executed in the aftermath of the fire, including Nathan Hill, who was captured during the roundup of spies and other suspicious folks after the fire. He was rounded up and executed then. Although the Continentals were able to mount a victory at Harlem Heights in mid-September, Howe defeated Washington in battle again and again after that. At White Plains, again at Fort Washington. He took Fort Lee, not in battle, but he took it within minutes of the last person leaving the fort with all of the goods still left in the fort. At the time that the Battle of Brooklyn was fought, it was by far the largest battle ever fought in North America. If the Royal Navy is included in the battle, and there's no reason they shouldn't be because they were there at sea in the rivers surrounding New York, over 40,000 men took part in the battle. Howe recorded his losses as 59 killed, 268 wounded, and 31 missing. The heavy casualties, which are the German mercenaries, were reported to be 5 killed and 26 wounded. The Americans suffered much heavier losses. Around 300 had been killed. A great number, maybe twice that, wounded, and then 1,000 captured. This was a serious, a very serious battle. in the American Revolutionary War. Certainly it was a victory for the British and a defeat for the Continentals. But the amount of lessons learned in the Battle of Brooklyn and the following battles of Fort Washington, Lee, and White Plains, Harlem Heights, these all occurred in rapid succession, and the lessons learned from these enabled Washington, who, while at the time he had quite a few shortcomings, he was not a man who did not learn. He learned from these battles, and with those lessons that he learned, he very rapidly began to emerge as the military commander that was needed by the nation. Certainly there were many battles afterwards, but Washington and the Continental forces were driven further westward until they were forced out of New York, then out of New Jersey, and finally pushed across the Delaware. But by the winter, by winter's onset, they'd been pushed across the Delaware. But we know that at the very end of the year, the end of December, and by New Year's Day, the tides began to turn, with Washington recrossing the Delaware, attacking Trenton and Princeton, being victorious in those battles, which turned the tide of the war. So, that is the story of the Battle of Brooklyn Heights, the Battle of Long Island, and we've got a few more minutes left. Let me see. I want Mr. Martinez, if he's listening, I want him to call in. And while we're doing that, I'm going to give you a quick rundown of the additional battles that were running in August. We talked about the Battle of Gloucester, the shelling of Stonington, the Battle of Long Island, the siege of Fort Stanwix. Now, that began August 2nd, 1777. That began a year after the Battle of Long Island. Now, I've talked to you guys. I'm not going to go into this. As much as I would like to, I'm not going to go into this because I've done it over and over. I've talked to you guys about the siege of Fort Stanwix and the Battle of Oriskany. These were also two watershed battles because these two battles destroyed one of the three prongs of an attack into New York, into the Hudson Valley, which was designed to separate the colonies. And the Battle of Oriskany can't be considered an American victory. We do know that it was instrumental in destroying the third prong of the attack and thereby limiting the damage that was able to be done by that prong of the attack. These were the two close battles of Stanwix and the Battle of Oriskany. Now, you know that Stanwix set on the trade route, the waterway, from the New England coast into the Great Lakes. If you wanted to do any trading, any movement of anything, it had to be done by water. There were no roads at the time. And Fort Stanwix set on the portage point from the waterway into the Great Lakes and controlled that. That was a very important position. The Battle of Bennington, August 16th, 1777. The Battle of Staten Island, August 22nd, 1777. The Battle of Setauket, August 22nd. The Siege of Pondicherry, August 1778. Now, just a note about this. The Siege of Pondicherry was the first military action during the war on the Indian subcontinent following the declaration of war between Great Britain and France. Once France had come in on the side of the colonists, then the war between France and Great Britain was reignited. And this portion of their war was being fought in Pondicherry, India. So the war was not it was not being fought only in the Americas. It was fought all over the world. Battle of Rhode Island, August 29th, 1778. Now, a word about this battle. It was also known as the Battle of Quaker Hill and also known as the Siege of Newport. This took place on August 29th, 1778. The Continental Army and additionally connected to that were military forces under the command of General Sullivan were withdrawing to the northern part of Aquidneck Island after abandoning the siege of Newport, Rhode Island, when the British forces in Newport sorted out, supported by the recently arrived Navy ships, and attacked the retreating Americans. The battle ended inconclusively. There were no real winners or anything, but the Continental forces afterwards withdrew to the mainland, leaving Aquidneck Island in the British hands. Now, the battle took place in the aftermath of the first attempt at cooperation between the French and American forces following France's entry into the war as an American ally. This was the first battle once the Americans and French had gotten together. The operations against Newport were to have been made in conjunction with the French fleet arriving in troops. And these were the battle plans were frustrated in part by difficult relations between the commanders. You had the American commanders and the French commanders, and early on they were not able to get along that well. I'm sure that the Continental commanders did not want to be considered amateurs or less than equal to the French, and the French did not want to make the Continentals think that they were certainly that they could never be equal to the great French army and troops. This caused difficulty quite a bit during the early stages of the American and French alliance. Now, I want to make another point that was notable about this battle. The battle was fairly notable because of the participation of the 1st Rhode Island Regiment. This was a locally recruited regiment of African Americans. It was a segregated regiment, meaning it was an all-black regiment. And that is a large body. I'm not sure what this regiment size was, but it could be 600 to 700 men. It's the only major military action that included a racially segregated unit on the American side of the war. But here we have the first case of an all-black unit fighting for independence in the American Revolutionary War. And I think that's pretty amazing. All right. We've got about 4 minutes. For those 4 minutes, I just want to say that we have I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. I hope that the information was of use to you. Like I said, I love reading about the American Revolutionary War. I love talking about it. I love answering questions that you guys didn't call in and ask. And I really enjoy the history. But I also want to let you know that the way that I pay for doing the radio show is by teaching different forms of firearms use under the guise of Battle Road USA. Myself and my partner, Mr. Mark Martinez, and we're running events over the course of the next few months. Now we've finally seen ammunition back on shelves. We've got a women's self-defense and safety course that's running Saturday, day after tomorrow, here in Central Texas in Davila. This is a course designed to teach women the basic operation of loading and firing and manipulating the most common types of shotguns, rifles, and pistols in use today, so that hopefully after the course these women are able to pick up various types of shotguns, rifles, and pistols. They're able to determine if it is loaded or unloaded. They're able to open the action or open the cylinder or to get the magazine out or load or prep a magazine and load a magazine and chamber around and fire it. Then on August 31st, Battle Road USA is holding a fighting shotgun course. We're going to teach you how to use that home defense or personal defense shotgun. We're going to teach you how to use it as it is meant to be used when defending yourself or your loved ones in your home or some other location. This is a great course. We've already run this course a couple of times. I'm telling you, it's a great course. We have the on October 12th, we have the Battle Road USA Zombie Run and Gun 4.5-mile looping course with 8 shooting stations. November 9th and 10th, we have the Combat Carbine course. November 11th through the 15th, we have the Precision Rifle Sniper course. November 19th to the 23rd, we have Squad School. And then we have additional courses being run the rest of the year and starting in the new year. For more information, go to battleroadusa.com. I want to thank CMD, my co-host. Every time I'm here, he's here. Thanks. Thank you, Sam. God bless you. And we will see you next Thursday, 7 p.m. Central.